Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Celtic Soul podcast. I'm Andrew Millen, and today on the show, my guest will be Derry writer and activist Tony Doherty. Tony is the founding member of the Bloody Sunday campaign, a former IRA prisoner, and his father, Patrick, was executed on Bloody Sunday in 1972. I'd like to thank you all for your continued support as we produce our free content across all our platforms. As I've said before, we do not go behind a Patreon and we don't put anything behind a paywall. So if you've been enjoying the podcast and you can't afford it, please hit the donate button on our homepage at CelticFanzine.com, and for as little as the price of a pint, we can continue to grow the podcast and our other independent Celtic media platforms as we enter our 20th season producing independent Celtic fan-driven media. And folks, we're looking for episode sponsors for the new season and for the fanzine. And advertisers have the benefit of advertising on all our platforms in video, audio, fanzine, social media and on our website. I always get tongue-tied when I say this, but we are fully fan-funded and sponsored by Celtic-minded businesses, Celtic supporters, clubs and individuals who share our values. And for more information, you can contact us through the website, on social media, or by emailing us at info@celticfanzine.com. And on the website, you can also support us by becoming a member, buying some of our merch or fanzine, subscribing, or as I said there, donating for the price of a pint. And don't forget to check out our merchandise on our online shop, and our new Celtic t-shirts are up there. We've got the One Star Means More, and also the United Colours of Celtic, which has proven very popular. Well, the Euros finish on Sunday night, and hopefully football will not be coming home to England, but we'll be going to Italy. I'll be supporting the local Italian restaurant and then the local Irish pub. I've always had a soft spot for the Italians. Well, since Wednesday night anyway, before that I was very fond of Denmark. It's just the way football is in rivalry, isn't it? Don't forget, folks, you can still download the digital edition of issue 115, and we're currently starting the walk on issue 116 of the fanzine. Thanks very much for everyone who bought the print edition. It's sold out now. And we thank you once again for all the support. And don't forget, if you do subscribe, you will receive a free t-shirt. And talking about t-shirts, I got a great deal during the week from Declan McLaughlin. I got two CDs and a t-shirt for the price of a pint. Well, price of 4 points, really. But £20, folks, for that deal. So check out Declan's social media pages, and he'll also be playing us out at the show today with a tune called Running Uphill. So Declan, we're loving your stuff, and we'll continue to support you, and hopefully you'll come down and play for us in the studio and maybe in a venue when it's safe to do so and all this COVID is over. Anyway, so what's been happening on the Celtic front? Well, the players and the manager are down having a pre-season camp in Wales, and they beat Sheffield Wednesday in the first pre-season game on Wednesday. I watched the match at home, and I have to say it was unusual because we had three halves. Well, not so really three halves, but they did play three 30-minute halves, I suppose, games on a nice summer's afternoon, I must say. And lovely setting they are in. As I said last week, they're not in the sunshine of Dubai, but it was lovely and sunny, and there was a a wee cricket game going on in the background as well. So a very pleasant afternoon and a 3-1 win. And you know what? There was a good mix of experience players out there and plenty of youth on display for the manager to look at. And after falling behind to an early goal there, the boys settled in and won 3-1. And people say results are not important in these games, it's all about the fitness, but I wouldn't want to see Celtic lose an argument, never mind a game. And one young player who caught my eye, and others, because I got a few messages about him and I seen a few bits on social media, was Owen Moffat. He reminded me a bit of, in looks anyway, of Jamie from 90s Liverpool band Space, with his flowing ginger locks. And hopefully we'll get to see more of him during the rest of the pre-season, with the returning international players from the Euros joining up with the squad. And that means some of the younger players will be making way. And talking about younger players, it was great to see young Rocco Vatta signing a new contract. Rocco, of course, is son of Rudy, who we've had on the podcast, and Rocco's also cutting his teeth on the international youth circuit with Ireland. Thank God we lost a couple of players to the English team. They used to sing Ron Levine, now they sing God Save the Queen, young Grealish and young Royce. But hopefully we can keep Rocco, because he's chose us so far over Scotland and his father's country of birth, Albania. And if you've been tuning into us during the week, folks, you'll see we've been busy in the recording studio. We had Matt McGlone on from the Alternative View. He joined us for a chat as we look ahead to pre-season and the upcoming season and chat about the new manager. And we've also had John Hartson and Paul McQuaid chatting to us. Paul from Celtic Shed, and John, of course, a bit of a Celtic legend. And them podcasts and videos will go out over the next couple of days. And as this podcast goes out, we hope to be sitting down with a current Celtic player to ask him a question or two about pre-season and the season ahead. And we'll also have that up across our channels on audio and on video. So please visit Celtic Fanzine TV, folks, on YouTube. Hit the subscribe button. I think there's a little alarm button. You can hit that as well, and that'll alert you when we have anything coming out, and you'll never miss an episode. And on there as well, you can check out our playlist where we have all our shows, Talk from the Terrace, Celtic AM, Millage Meets, Celtic Soul Shots, Grand Old History, and with the bits and pieces from Celtic. And we also have all the audio of the Celtic Soul podcast up there as well now. And they are available also across all platforms. So don't forget to hit the subscribe button on your preferred platform or provider. And all podcasts, both audio and video, are also available on CelticFanzine.com. And you can also subscribe for the newsletter there and check out our news and interviews and bits and pieces we put up during the week there. And thanks for reading, listening and watching. Tony Docherty is a writer and activist from Derry. He's published 3 books, This Man's Wee Boy, The Derby Siders and The Scalper and Me. He's a founding member of the Bloody Sunday campaign and a former IRA prisoner. His father was executed on Bloody Sunday by members of the British Army Parachute Regiment, along with 12 other innocent civilians, on January the 30th, 1972. Hi Tony, you're very welcome to the Celtic Soul podcast. At a time when Bloody Sunday has been recently back in the news, with a former member of the British Army's Parachute Regiment charged with murder and attempted murders on Bloody Sunday. And the news is now he will not stand trial. And prosecutors have told the families the man referred to as Soldier F. How does this make you feel?
I was hoping you're going to ask me an easier question there, Andrew. Well, it's to be honest with you, you're never that far away from it, regardless of what is going on. But the recent matters with regard to Soldier F, in many respects, have brought it back to the centre of things, and obviously to the forefront of my mind as well. The thing about Soldier F is that the report of the Savile Inquiry that came out in 2010 basically found that he was responsible for killing 5 people, and he acted without fear or panic. You know, so he was cool and collected the whole time, and he also attempted to wound another number of our innocent civil rights marchers. So he was then charged in 2019 with the murders of 2. One of the 5 was my father, but he wasn't charged with his murder, and also the attempted murder of a few others. And ever since then, you know, there's the trial or the pre-trial processes have been excruciating, taking an inordinate amount of time. Major issues about his ongoing anonymity, quality of evidence, all the stuff that they could use to obfuscate the processes have been used. So they're not going to be let go easy. I mean, clearly the idea of Soldier F or somebody like Soldier F being charged isn't a popular idea with the British military, nor between the British military and the current Tory government, or any British government for that state. I think it probably would be no different had Labour been in power. So it's deeply unpopular in Britain, and I think what they have been doing over this last while is trying every trick in the book with regard to the particulars of Soldier F's trial. And then that came to the fore last Thursday when it was indicated by the Public Prosecution Service that the charges that they were intending to not pursue the prosecution any further because they didn't think there was a reasonable likelihood that a criminal conviction would be brought about. However, just today that the intention of the prosecution service has been stalled at the High Court, and so it the imminence of the charges being dropped against Soldier F is now probably going to take to September to resolve. That's obviously for the murder and attempted murder charges. Bear in mind that Soldier F and quite a few of the R military people who were involved in Bloody Sunday on the day also stand to face charges of perjury during the Savile inquiry itself, which sat between 2001 and 2007, I think, and eventually reported in 2010. So the prospects of a murder charge don't look the best. I mean, I'm just saying that from a lay person and somebody who's directly affected. But if that's the case, I think we could have an Al Capone scenario where Al Capone he's not convicted of the various sort of gangster crimes that were committed by him and his gang in Chicago in the 1930s. He was eventually charged and convicted of tax evasion. So the chances are this may go on against Soldier F from the point of view of perjury, but that would obviously be a relatively minor consideration. So it's still there. I mean, to be honest with you, you walk into your history every day in Derry because it's so everything happened in very sort of close quarters. So you're never too far away from it, but the Soldier F thing has brought it back to the front and centre.
Yeah, and like when we think of those murders on Bloody Sunday, you know, we think of the iconic images, the black and white pictures, you know, the videos or the film footage. But before Bloody Sunday, you know, you were only 9 on that day, on a fateful day. So, but life before then and, you know, memories of your dad. And can you tell us a little bit your dad and, you know, who he was?
Yeah. Well, I suppose my father was central to my first book, actually, and the first book is called This Man's Wee Boy, and I suppose had to sort of resurrect his memory from my own childhood memories and from those of my brother and sisters and our people close to the family. So my father was a working class man, born and raised in the Brandywell area, where we were brought up as well. For long periods of his life, he had to cross to England to work in various jobs because there was no work in Derry. There was no work in Derry, particularly for Catholic males. There was plenty of work for females in the shirt factories and so on, but there was very little for Catholic men. So a lot of the men folk would have had to immigrate at different times to raise enough money for their families, and my father would have been among that group. When he was killed, he was working for DuPont. He was one of the lucky ones in Derry at the time to get a job with DuPont multinational. We lived in a small terrace house in the Brandywell in Hamill Street, two up, two down. We had very much an impoverished upbringing, but we didn't know that at the time. This was just normal for us being brought up in the Brandywell with practically nothing in terms of worldly goods, as it were. But it was, I mean, we all had a very happy childhood. We were well reared. My father was very religious, and he would have taken us to Mass as children every Sunday, and during the retreat, we would have been made to walk forced walk to the chapel as well. I'm sure a lot of people had the same experiences as ourselves. But he was a very religious man, very, very simple man. He was somebody who was involved and very interested in civil rights, not necessarily Republican politics, because that didn't really feature for our family in the 1960s. And on the day of Bloody Sunday itself, he was a steward on behalf of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association. So there was six of us children. The youngest was born in June 1971. My younger brother Glenn was only 6 months when my father was killed. So there were six of us, four boys and two girls. And my mother was 28, I think, when my father was killed. So I've written about this extensively, and I've had the pleasure in a sense of getting to know my father again through memories and connecting all the different memories up to write an account of his life connected to my life in the context of the family, and then growing up in the times that we did through the 1960s. I was born in 1963, and right through to the beginnings of the troubled period and 1968 and 69. I remember it really being taken to civil rights demonstrations in the city centre. We didn't really know what they were, but they were considered safe enough, you know, for parents to take children. So I remember them very well. But I think by the summer of 1969, I think there was more of a threat. There was a portent of bad things to come. Let's say, and the climate changed considerably at that time, in the days and weeks in the run up to the Battle of Bogside. We lived close enough to the Bogside itself, and then from 1970 on, you could sense, even as a child, with the onset of the British soldiers on the streets, which started off blissfully, by the way, at the beginning, because the soldiers were welcomed, you know, for good or wrong reasons. They were welcomed, and particularly they were welcomed by the children of the Brandywell, because they would have sent us to the shops to buy stuff for them, and they were all young squatties, so money didn't mean that much to them. So they would have handed us maybe 50 pence for going to the shop, and 50 pence in those days was a lot of money. Or it wouldn't have been 50 pence in them days, but maybe half a crown or 10 bob. That was a lot of money. So the idea of the soldiers being on the streets was popular in a sort of grown-up sense, but from a child's point of view, it was very popular as well. And it was exciting in a sense to have soldiers on the streets, camped at your street corner, As I say, I've written about this extensively, and writing about the family was a very exciting thing for me to do, because I'd forgotten a lot about my father and the times that we were brought up. But I suppose in my adult times, I always knew that I would write something, but I wasn't too sure what. Until I read Seamus Dean's book, Reading in the Dark. He wrote about Derry in the 1940s and 50s. And once I read that, I knew that I would also write my memoirs. And then I think family circumstances for me changed around 2013, 2014. So I started writing. I started the idea, I suppose, of writing and reading quite a lot. Particularly childhood memoirs. And so I suppose copied the styles of some of the stuff that I read. And then I had the bones of a book done, and I sent some of it to a number of publishers. I remember sending it on a Sunday night to the Mercier Press at 10:30. On a Sunday night, and by 10 o'clock the next morning, I had a response, and I knew by the response that it was going to work out. So the first book, This Man's Wee Boy, really tells a story about my first memories about 1967 up to the period immediately before and including Bloody Sunday. So the book can be got on Amazon. By the way, it's called This Man's Wee Boy. And that's my favourite book, but I wrote another two, one about the aftermath, I suppose, of Bloody Sunday from a child to teenage perspective, including the period that I became involved in the IRA, and then the third one, the Scalper and Me, again was about reconnecting with my father in later life, my present days, and then the journey that I took from prison to realizing that I had to do something about the legacy of Bloody Sunday and the human rights sort of element of Bloody Sunday as well. And this would have been in the 1980s and early 1990s. So that's the three books basically span those sort of critical periods of childhood, teenage years, and then into adulthood.
Yeah, Tony, we all look back to our teenage years and you know, things that influence us, you know, normal things like football, music, sport, you know, girlfriends and that. But the teenage years after Bloody Sunday for those in Derry must have been there must have been big challenges ahead for, you know, young people, you know, to get their head around what happened. And, you know, was there a sense that, you know, you had to get revenge for your father's killing?
There definitely was a sense of that. It's important also to point out that that in the immediate aftermath of Bloody Sunday, there was no police investigation. This is, you know, when 13 people were killed within the space of 20 minutes, and an hour, 13 were injured. You would think somebody in the RUC would have commissioned some type of criminal investigation. So nothing like that happened, and so in many respects, the aftermath is as important as what happened on the day itself, because you had to deal with the propaganda machine kicked in right away, and it was obviously preconceived that the British Army had engaged not human rights or civil rights demonstrators, but members of the IRA in a gun battle, and had taken out so many gunmen and bombers. That's what the initial story said in the hours following the killings, and that's by and large what the British stuck to right through the 1970s, the 1980s, and right through the Savile inquiry. It's incredible what people would be prepared to believe. And then what happened, instead of there being a criminal investigation, there was a judicial inquiry led by Lord Widgery, who was the Lord Chief Justice of England at the time, the highest judicial position that he could get. And he basically whitewashed the whole affair. By and large, agreed with the assertions of the soldiers that they had come under attack. Some of the gunmen could have been involved, could have been bombers, and so on and so forth. And it left it sufficiently open that most of the blame was piled on those who were murdered, the wounded, those who had actually organised the civil rights demonstration, which was organised, by the way, to try and free people from internment. And none of the blame whatsoever was attributed to the soldiers. The soldiers' actions were, by and large, skipped over and described in like enough terms. So we grew up with that. I mean, as you say, I was only nine on Bloody Sunday. I didn't really realise what was all going on at the time, and because nobody really sits down and tells you, and you have to sort of work it out. But the years, so I knew whatever happened was chronically bad, but it didn't have the detail of what happened to my father and the rest of the men and boys that were killed, but it was always there. It was always there as a backdrop and in the foreground. So it was always behind me, but it was always in front of me as well. And I think that was by and large the same, not just for people like me who were directly affected and lost someone on Bloody Sunday, but I think by a whole generation of teenagers in Derry, and actually throughout the north, and I'm sure throughout the island, who felt that they needed to do something about Bloody Sunday. And I remember very shortly after Bloody Sunday, basically making a commitment that I would join the IRA when I grew up. And by 1972, the IRA was a fully fledged guerrilla organization. And I had pledged even at that stage. Because I remember one time we were playing in the street. It might have been July or August. It was a sunny day. And both my aunt and my mom were at the front door in Hamilton Street, where we still lived. And I remember shouting over to my aunt, what age do you have to be to join the IRA? And I was still 9 at the time. And she laughed and says, oh, you have to be 16, but it'll be well over by the time you reach that age, you know. So you could see from that, you can sense from that what my preoccupations were with regard to my father's death. And also, I suppose, growing up in a highly militarised situation. I mean, Derry was heavily militarised at the time. There was an army base at the bottom of our street and another one further up the road. And Derry was dotted, speckled with army bases at the time. And the military basically took command and control of the city centre as well. Not unlike what would have happened in, you know, cities like Dublin and Limerick and Galway, Cork during the late 1920s. So that's the type of position situation that we grew up in. We grew up to hit the British Army. There was riots in the streets practically every day. The Brandywell was a battleground, which in some senses was exciting for us as children. But I always say that I would have hated being a parent of young children in the early 1970s or at any stage of the 1970s, because it must have been a nightmare wondering where your children were. Were they involved in riots, which could happen spontaneously on the street, or, you know, God forbid, they could get involved with the IRA and you might never see them again. So not knowing what would happen to their children I mean, I know some of the families directly affected by Bloody Sunday. The McKinneys, who are good friends of mine, their brother, Willie McKinney, I think was 24 when he was killed on Bloody Sunday. And any time Bloody Sunday come on the news, the father would get up and turn the TV off. And they never spoke about it. And they knew that they shouldn't speak about it. And I remember speaking to their mother many years ago, and she said to me that they felt that if they didn't talk about it, nothing bad, nothing further bad would happen to the family. And by bad, they meant losing another son to the IRA or going to prison or any of the things that could have happened, being hit by a rubber bullet or being hit by a live bullet. So a whole generation of young parents and young to middle-aged parents grew up with the stress and the trauma of the conflict, because they knew that their young people would be vulnerable to revenge, as I was and what all my friends were as well. That's what we talked about. We were constantly, you know, pretending to be members of the IRA when we were 10. We, you know, you may have grown up with cowboys and Indians or whatever. We grew up, it was the IRA and the British Army, and we were the IRA, and we would plan attacks on the British Army and all that, what some children would do. But it obviously became deeply ingrained and implanted in a whole generation. And so when I reached the age of 17, you had to be 16. You had to be 16 to get into the junior IRA, the Fianna na hÉireann. And I joined them at that stage. It would have been 1979 or so. But that all happened again in the backdrop of discos and dances and girls and all the rest of it. So in some senses, our teenage years were normalised by pop music and all of that. But the big difference for us was that if you can out of a disco or out of a dance, the chances are you would get involved in a riot or something would happen between the people leaving the community centre and the British Army and the RUC. That was almost a foregone conclusion every Friday, Saturday and Sunday. So those are the circumstances which we grew up in. And then, as I say, I joined the junior IRA in 79. And when I went on then to join the IRA proper in 1980, I was asked, I wrote about this actually in my second book, about the recruitment process, the progression on from the junior IRA to the IRA proper. And there was a number of us gathered in a kitchen in Chantallow, which is a housing estate. It just used to be in the outskirts of the city, built in the middle of the countryside. We were all asked what our motivation was to join the IRA, and I answered by saying that I wanted to take revenge for my father. And the recruitment person who had asked the question stopped me and said, "That's not a good enough reason to join the IRA." So I was actually stopped from joining the IRA, but I was allowed a second go. And I come back and I had my answers worked out well in advance this time. So I progressed into the IRA in 1980. And it was, I mean, I directly attribute my desire to join the IRA as a vengeful desire. It was motivated by the tyranny of the state. There's no real way you can put it. It wasn't naivety. It wasn't somebody banging a drum. It was, for me, it was pure logic. Because in terms of what happened on Bloody Sunday and the aftermath in terms of justice, there was nowhere else to go. In my head, there was nowhere else to go. It was logical for me and for a whole generation of young people to do what I did. Actually, when I went to prison, as you said at the start, in 1981. My IRA career didn't progress very far, which in some senses is fortunate, certainly for me. But when I went into the Crumlin Road prison in 1981, I was shocked to hear that so many people of my generation had joined the IRA because of Bloody Sunday. And that just wasn't people from Derry where I'm from. This was people throughout the north, actually, and some people from other parts of the island as well. So it did have a very profound effect. The massacre had a very profound effect, but also the propaganda afterwards had a very profound effect, and the denial of justice over the years, I think, had a huge effect on a whole generation of young men and women in this city and beyond. And I think that, you know, ultimately led to the prolongation of what we call then the long war. So that's really what motivated me as a young man. It was to take revenge against the tyranny of the state.
Yeah, and like only down the road, and I think about my teenage years, like when you, like you said, you know, you go to a disco, you know, there was girls, there was music, there was crack. But you know when you're coming out, you know, when we're coming out, you know, we're trying to avoid getting a thumping from maybe a local hardman, and, you know, we're looking forward to a bag of chips, but you're coming out to harassment and possibly rioting. So there's, not, there's nothing normal about that.
Well, it was not, by the time I was a teenager, 14, 15, 16, it had become normalised for us. So the whole sort of heavy militarization and the whole thing about resistance through the IRA had become completely normalized for us. That's in effect, we had grown up at the commencement of hostilities, let's say, in 1970, 71. We just grew up with that, and that became part of our life and times, became part of how you walked from one part of the city to another without getting stopped by the British Army. You know, choosing your route. That was a very, very common thing for us. So if you were Diddon Gairds, for instance, in Craigan, which was a good 4 or 5 miles from our house, and you walked everywhere in those days, there's no such thing as a taxi. You had to basically work out the route that you were less likely to be stopped and searched and harassed by the British Army and the RUC. It didn't always work. But then sometimes you would find yourself literally in the dead of night surrounded by British Army personnel, RUC personnel. And it was obviously worse if something had happened earlier on. More times than enough, you wouldn't walk home. You would walk to the nearest aunt's house or your granny's or something like that, so you wouldn't have to do the full trek home. Again, that was just something we grew up detesting the British Army. It was clear they detested us. We grew up detesting the RUC, which was the police service at the time, and they detested us. That was clear. Those were just the terms of the street conflict at the time, and rioting was a daily, weekly pastime. And when we got out of secondary school, We got out of school. Our school was in Craigan, St. Joseph's. And when you get out of school, you were almost guaranteed a riot every day when you get out, because the British soldiers would be waiting at the gate for us. So, and they were all young men as well, but they were obviously heavily armed with automatic rifles and plastic bullet guns and rubber bullet guns and gas and all the rest of it. Or if you didn't get a riot there, we would have walked from Craigan down to the Bogside, and you would have got your riot. So it was a daily occurrence. That's what they say, if you were rioting every day. But you know, by the mid 70s, you know, when I sort of came of age as a teenager, it was a common occurrence. It was just something that, you know, we were prolific rioters. The right arm was 10 times stronger than the left, and with a deadly aim and all that, you know.
Yeah, and it just gets me thinking when you know, you mentioned the word teenage, and I think the undertones from Derry, and I think a teenage kicks, and it puts a whole different perspective. Because when you were, I suppose, getting it more involved in the Republican movement, you know, these boys, there was some lads in the area, and they were appearing on Top of the Pops, and that must have been surreal, like for
I remember going to see the undertones at the local disco. I would say it would have been 1978. I mean, the whole sort of explosion of punk rock was just sort of, it was just integrated into this sort of scenario of conflict between us as teenagers and the British Army. Punk just happened. Some of the punk rockers would have been riding as well, so they weren't entirely sort of immune from it. But I suppose for us, the stuff like the undertones was a bizarre sort of occurrence during the whole sort of normality of the conflict. By the way, the two undertones, John and I can't remember the other fellow's name. Their father was the coroner in Derry. And it was their father that delivered the coroner's report, where he described the killings of Bloody Sunday as sheer unadulterated murder. And he got into trouble for, believe it or not, in Derry, he got into trouble with the authorities for using the terminology that they did. So there was a direct connection between Bloody Sunday and the undertones. In some senses, it was a great time. Growing up, I mean, in many respects, I wouldn't swap any of the 1970s, you know, because it was a backdrop of all that, of music, disco music, punk, and all the rest of it. And it was just integrated into our lives and normalised. As I say, I mean, the whole idea of dating a girl or going to a disco was just integrated into the whole conflict scenario. You still had to protect yourself and be careful no matter what you were doing, or less careful depending on your way of working, you know?
Yeah, and you were, when you did join the IRA, as you said, it wasn't long before you were behind bars. Mm-hmm. Do you remember much about, you know, the process when you going out on active service, getting lifted, going through the courts, and then you would have been in the prison during the hunger strikes, would you?
Yeah. I actually went down the on to the wing in Crumlin Road on the 1st of March 1981, which was the day that Bobby Sands went on hunger strike. And obviously he came from a generation, well, maybe half a generation before me. So I would have been in prison throughout all that time. I went in 81 and got out in 85. It was a time of great turbulence. Personally, it was turbulent, you know, losing your relative freedom to being left inside. You know, and you think back now that the process was delivered at lightning speed, although it obviously dragged out at the time. And you think that these things are never going to end, but there's always tomorrow. But there was a great sense of camaraderie and comradeship, I suppose, between the prisoners in Crumlin Road at the time and actually any of the jails in which you found IRA prisoners. People weren't left in their own devices. They were assisted and supported by our prisoners, and that was just the mentality that they had, and I ended up adopting as well. The other thing that I noticed when I was in prison was the number of people who were charged and subsequently convicted of a whole range of offences, including murder, who were completely innocent and whose cases will never reach the public domain, nor a successful judicial outcome, clearing their names. There was actually one young man who I wrote about in a full chapter in my third book called The Scalper and Me. And he was arrested a number of nights after Bobby Sands died in the 5th of May. I think the young man from the New Lodge Road in Belfast was arrested a number of nights afterwards and confessed to a murder of an RUC man in the Dunkirk area of Belfast. And he was, the RUC actually convinced him that much that he did the murder. That when he came in to my cell 5 on the ones, the first Latin on Common Road, he actually told me in the cell, which is the two of us, how he had committed the killing, what weapon he had used, how he had sighted up the RUC man and all the rest of it. And he had not a single thing to do with the RUC man's killing. Not a single thing. But his head had been turned that much in Castlereagh that he left thinking, I've done that. I've confessed to it. And I'm going to spend a long number of years in prison, which he did. And there was a lot of people that got, actually, who went to Birmingham 6, they went to Guildford 4, but they were, happened to be living in the wrong house, in the wrong place at the wrong time, and who were picked up and had confessions forced out of them. And that used to happen, hand over fist, in those days. And that, I think that's particularly sad because, I mean, obviously it's, you know, a life was lost or something untoward happened, but also our lives were destroyed through the judicial processes. And many people that I knew in prison, I would say I could name a dozen who were innocent of very serious charges, were subsequently convicted to life imprisonment. And as I say, none of that will really ever come to will come into the news, at least not through anything that I'm currently aware of. But it was wholesale at the time. I mean, I did do what I was eventually convicted of doing. So I have no argument in that regard. But if you look at the way that the whole judicial system was stacked against people like me, I mean, I was charged with, if you compare me to Soldier F, for instance, Soldier F had executed 5 people within a 15-minute period and had tried to execute an unknown number of hours. He had the whole weight of the government apparatus on his side. I joined the IRA directly because of his actions, and the non-actions of the state. And I ended up serving 4 years, doing 4 years for what I did. And many other people served long sentences for what they didn't do. And I think that is just a travesty, which is not that often picked up in the narrative and how the conflict is described and how the legacy is described. But it's there, it happened. And that's, I suppose that's why we're here at this moment in time, still arguing the toss about the legacy and the pursuit of justice against killers like Soldier F.
And when you come out of prison, or even during your time in prison, you obviously have a lot of time to think. Were you there when, obviously the hunger strikers, they went on hunger strike for the demands, and then eventually those demands would be given to wear your own clothes, yeah, and the like. You would have been in prison when this change was happening.
Right through that period, yeah, right through that period and the aftermath of the hunger strike. I remember when I ended up to the Long Cache, the always known as the Maze prison. It would have been January 1982, and I remember seeing the name of a hunger striker, Tom McElby, very, very freshly cut in to the paintwork on the heating pipes. And you know, the the hunger strike was obviously very, very real and very close, but I never felt as close to it than I did when I went up to the cache and saw his, because he had died, I think, I think it might have been July, 1981. And I went to the long case, it would have been 6 months after that. But I remember seeing his name etched into the pipe, Tom Ackleby. And also remember seeing the irregular verbs written in Irish on the wall that had been painted over. Somebody had taken the time to, because I suppose a lot of the prisoners wouldn't have been given paper or pens or writing or reading material. People had to learn Irish on the hoof, out through the doors, shouting across the land and so on. But I remember all the regular verbs were all written on the wall. And, it might have been the lead, or it could have been the corner of something, or but somebody had whitewashed over the top of them, but you could still see them very, very clear. So for me, that those two things were revelations. You know, literally, you know, seeing the name and the pipe etched in but painted over, and then seeing the irregular verbs and Irish song written on the wall. So I knew that I had sort of entered a different place with a particular history.
And coming out of prison, Tony, you have to be a changed person. Has to have changed.
Well, and I suppose I mean, you do have to grow up quick in those circumstances. I was a very young and impressionable teenager when I went to prison, and I got out when I was 22 in April 1985. It's a great time to get out, by the way. Because I think the 80s were sort of a brilliant decade in their own right. I mean, you had the whole sort of miners' strike going on at the time. I would have sort of become quite politicised from a left-wing point of view. Did a lot of reading on socialism and read a lot of Connolly when I was in prison and got a better sort of worldview of politics and the need for change. So I get out, I suppose, a more informed and more rounded individual, not any less committed to the overthrow of the state. But I suppose I choose my weapons a wee bit more carefully the second time round, and would have become involved in a lot of community activity, Republican politics. I also had my first inkling that that it could be me that would end up doing something significant around Bloody Sunday as well. Because the day that I got out, there was a big do in the house, a big party in the house, and then the next day, or I think it might have been the day after, I walked. My plan, I got out on a Wednesday, and my plan on the Friday was to walk the whole length of the city, basically the route that I used to take on dates and stuff from Shantala to Craigan. They go to the cemetery, they visit my father's grave, and then they go up to my granny and grandfather's house. And so I went to my granny and grandfather's house, and they had still two of their own children. My uncle Joseph and my aunt Lorraine were still living with them. But I remember me having a conversation about with my grandfather about Bloody Sunday, and we talked about what I might end up doing. And he said to me, you know, I'm paraphrasing now, but he said something like, "You have done your bit in prison. What you should be doing is looking at what can be undone about Bloody Sunday." And it was my grandfather on my mother's side, Connor Quigley, who put the idea in my head in a very real way, because it's you do listen to your elders, and you should listen to your elders, because they're wise in different ways than you are. They're more worthy. But it was him who put the idea in my head that it would be me that would do something. So, and in 1985, it was actually quite difficult to see what could be done, because you were still literally in a war situation, war-torn city. No inkling or idea of justice. It was all heads down. The IRA were still very much in full flight against the British Army and the RUC, and vice versa. So there was nobody was really thinking about justice, but it was my grandfather that put the idea in my head that I could end up, I could be me. And maybe he saw something in me that I didn't, to be honest with you. I'm not sure. But I started working with the families at the time, getting them together, actually, for the first time ever since 1972. So it was a full 13 years, you would have thought. They would have had more to do with one another. But they didn't. And they didn't, because they were scared about raising the issue, because they were fearful that if they did, it would have a negative roll-on effect on their children, and maybe by that stage their grandchildren. So a lot of them didn't. And but I sort of gathered a good rapport with quite a lot of them, and then they wouldn't all have been Republicans like myself, but I always felt that there was an obvious bond between us that would transcend any sort of party political affiliations or beliefs that we had, and that's the way we conducted it from the very outset. And then by what actually happened then is that the Guildford 4 were released, and then the Birmingham 6 were released, and I think that started it stirred something in people like myself that we could be dealing with the art of the possible. Here you had two long-running campaigns to free innocent men and women that had come to fruition after more than a decade of imprisonment. And so that got people thinking, people like myself thinking, that maybe there is something that can be done here. And the state didn't appear to be as monolithic as it once did. So by 1982, utilising the 20th anniversary, we very deliberately, as in some of the families and our political activists, we deliberately set the 20th anniversary up as a platform to establish a family-based campaign with the support of as many people as we could gather in the city around Bloody Sunday. And the plan was that we would do that within Derry, within Ireland, and with a focus on Britain, I suppose, but also internationally. So from 1992, we didn't really look back. We were on a roll. And to cut a long story short, I suppose, you had the outbreak of peace, you had the Good Friday Agreement, and the Good Friday Agreement came about in April 1998. But in January 1998, the British government announced the second inquiry into Bloody Sunday, again, which was an unprecedented outcome. There had never been a second inquiry into any event in Ireland or Britain. So we had sort of achieved something in that regard. And it was also international as well, because the British government at that stage, through negotiations with the likes of Martin McGuinness and John Hume, they agreed that they would introduce an international element to it, because we made it clear that there would be no trust between us. So you had all those things going on. You were dealing with the art of the possible during those change times. And then, so we had the inquiry, and all sort of ensued since then. And the inquiry was, you know, not the perfect process for families. I have to say it was by 2010 we had the report, and the report was it was heavy on innocence and light on guilt. I think that's probably the best way to describe it. And that it was heavy on the innocence of people like my father and the rest of the people who were killed and the wounded. But it was light when it came to actually having clear recommendations for guilt. Although it did very, very clearly place the guilt on the likes of Soldier F and ours. Then obviously on the same day as the release of the Savile report, David Cameron, who was a British Prime Minister at the time, gave his now very famous apology in the House of Commons, taking responsibility for his army's actions. And that, again, I suppose we viewed that as hugely significant at historical as well as in personal terms, because that had never... I mean, Britain has never apologised for any of its actions in Ireland, going back as long as you want. But here we were in 2010. We had a second inquiry. There was far more to us as a result of the inquiry, and we also had a government apology delivered by the British Prime Minister. So that, you know, that's a huge turnaround when you compare what happened in 1972, the whole outbreak of the propaganda war and so on, to what happened in 2010. There was a huge gulf in between, but the outcomes were vastly different. And I mean, we bagged that as a huge achievement, as a huge victory. We considered that we had been vindicated in our claims all along. And by the way, we were never always thanked for doing what we did. Many of the people involved in the campaign would have taken a lot of abuse, particularly down south, actually. I remember at one event we had in Phoenix Park, there were people driving by and called us child murderers and then speaking out and so on. So you had all that going on, all that sort of, I suppose that's probably a result of the propaganda war from an our perspective, where by the early 1990s onwards, people had a very, very skewed view or vision of what had happened north of the border. And I think as a result of Section 31 of the Broadcasting Act, that skewing was being played out on a day and daily basis. I mean, I remember being interviewed on RT on a number of occasions, and on each occasion they would ask me, was I a member of Sinn Féin? I would say no. But it was, a line wasn't, it didn't bar me in the least, but you still had to go through an interrogation and to be cleared in some way. And I was in Sinn Féin then, I'm not now, by the way, but that doesn't really matter. But you could see that there was a fear in the southern institutions to deal with the full reality of what happened north of the border. And a narrative had crept in over the years in Section 31 that strongly suggested that the only common enemy that people had in the south was the IRA and Republican violence, and all the rest of the stuff that happened was a result of that. And I think that was wrong. It was very, very skewed. It hasn't stood the test of time either, by the way. And I think that what's going on now, I think south of the border, is that all that history is being sort of unearthed. And I think a lot of the younger generation, certainly people younger than me, I think are starting to see that there was a lot wrong with that narrative. It was a badly skewed narrative. I mean, we're basically brushing whole phases of history under the carpet. The carpet was just becoming too bumpy to even walk on. And sooner or later, the outbreak of peace here in the north, I think a lot of people have revisited that history, and I've learned things about the North that they didn't know of, maybe weren't taught in school, didn't pick up from the media, but we're still there to be picked up. So in that sense, it's good that Section 31 has failed. And there's two or three generations now since the peace process that have grown up with a whole new perspective on the North and something approaching greater accuracy.
Yeah, and had Peter Hooton from the farm, and they're obviously looking for justice for the Hillsborough victims. And recently there was a judgment, which didn't support the police action, but they wouldn't be charged. Yeah. And I just messaged him and I said, how are you feeling? And he said devastated. And it was just one word. There was no, he didn't elaborate on it. And did you ever feel when something, especially the recent news, did you just feel mentally, physically exhausted and devastated by the whole process? Because you must be, everybody, all the families must be so mentally strong to continue, and it may be getting easier now, as you're saying, but there must have been some very, very hard years for everyone involved in the campaign.
Yeah, yeah. There's no doubt there were very dark days, and I've met the Hillsborough families on a number of occasions, and I've also met the families from the Stardust fire on a number of occasions, and the campaigns are very different, the resilience of the families is startlingly similar. And the personalities and the various campaigns are very similar as well, which is, in some senses, reassuring. So I think people like me need to be resilient, because there's no other way of doing it. As I say, your history here is it forms a backdrop, but it's also something in the foreground, and it and that's because it has never been fully resolved. I suppose the issue of justice is still outstanding, and it is very difficult at times to accept that the state will still move to protect the killers almost at any cost. And so you can see that through the Hillsborough. I mean, the Hillsborough campaign is very well led. They're a very, very resilient bunch of people, but they are seriously up against it as well, because the state will always protect itself. But I think the city of Liverpool itself, I think, is a great reflection of the spirit of struggle that the families sort of hold. Like, even if you look at the way, for instance, that the Sun newspaper is still not purchasable in Liverpool, but you can buy the Sun in Derry.
Shouldn't be purchased anywhere. It's a rag.
Shouldn't be purchased anywhere, exactly. But it just shows you how the city of Liverpool reacted to the families' wishes and desires at that time, that the Sun should never be sold again in Liverpool. I think that's something. I mean, even that single act is a tremendous act of solidarity, which every city should have something like that. That this is something that we are proud of. We stood by the people who have suffered as a result of the Hillsborough disaster. But you do see sort of fantastic sort of vestiges of resilience in every campaign. We look at the Stardust people, 1981. They're still rallying. They have actually forced the government now to hold a second inquest, a proper inquest, which I believe is going to commence in October this year. At one stage, you would hardly given a penny candle for the family's hopes of achieving any vestiges of justice. Yet, no, they stuck together. They sorted out their demands. They came to us looking for advice, as did the Hillsborough families, and we gave it freely. I mean, we've had the Hillsborough people and the Stardust people up in Derry on quite a number of occasions, and we have imparted ideas and tips and advice about how they should approach certain things, how they should use their the lobbying of all political parties, how to get to the heart of institutions, and so on and so forth. We sat them down and talked them through the whole thing. And while we, I mean, people like myself wouldn't claim victory on their behalf, but there is a solidarity that exists between struggling peoples, and you see it. It's just a natural thing that happens. People like us tend to gravitate towards one another. But I have no doubt that the Hillsborough people will achieve justice in their lifetime. And I have no doubt that the Hillsborough people will achieve justice as well. And I think that we've already achieved a vestige of justice through the establishment of truth. But there's always a road ahead. I think we're grown up enough now to realise that that's just the inevitability of struggle.
And your three books are all in print and all available to read for. And you said on that, did you say on Amazon?
They're all available on Amazon. You might get them in various bookshops around the country, but they can be they got reasonably easy. And I've been told, well, I don't tend to sort of recommend my own work, I'm a wee bit too modest, but I've been told that they are good reads, and I'm particularly attached to the first one, which I took great pleasure in writing, even though some of the source material, some of the sort of kernels of the various sort of short stories are difficult. I still really enjoyed the process. So they're good reads, and they'll give you a good insight into what ordinary life was about at the time. They're not sad tales, although there's sadness among it. I'm not that type of person that'll just give you a sad tale and then not give you something to cheer you up. So there's a lot of good humour in the books. I'm told that the books are good to very good, and the first book was first read by Jimmy McGovern, no less a person and somebody who has good contacts with the Hillsborough families as well, and he gave me a very good quote for the cover of it. And the second one, they got a quote from Frank McGuinness, who a playwright from Buckrana, who also spoke at the launch. And then for the third one, the scalper and me, Damien Dempsey, no less a person, gave me a quote. He was the first to read it outside of editors and so on. So they're, I'm told they're good books. They're full of humour, full of crack. There's obviously critical stories and critical issues within there to do with life and loss. Not least of all, my father. But they're not sad stories. They're good. They're good memoirs based on the lives and times of this man's wee boy, myself, growing up through my teenage years, out of prison, the Bloody Sunday campaign, and then Vindication. And it's all the characters that you meet along the way. So if you want to know anything about Derry in those times and even in modern times, you'll not do any better than read this man's wee boy, The Dead Beside Us, and The Scalper and Me. And you can get them on Amazon, or you probably get them in bookshops and various places as well.
And we had Declan McLaughlin on, who sells Derry as a tourist destination. But one thing about, you just mentioned there about the books, but there's also the Museum of Free Derry, which I'm sure is really worth visiting.
Yeah, I'm actually the chairperson of the museum, and it's now open after a long period being closed under the COVID restrictions. The Museum of Free Derry is what it says in the tin. I suppose it's a story of a risen people. It's a story of the state trying to kill the risen people and drive them off the streets. And it's a story of the rise of the Relatives campaign around Bloody Sunday and our eventual vindication. It's in my book, sorry, not actually in my book, but in my view, it is the best tourist facility in the city, if not the whole of the North West. So if you're Derry bound or North West, even Donegal bound, this year, call into the museum, you'll be made very welcome. We have a full staff, very professional, who will talk you through the history and assist you in various ways, or you can walk the museum by yourself. But I'll guarantee you it'll be an uplifting experience for you. So you'll be very welcome if you come to length.
Now, you said earlier on in the podcast that you know, Bloody Sunday is always behind you and it's always in front of you. But you have a life outside Bloody Sunday. You have a day job. Can you tell us a little about, away from the books and away from Bloody Sunday, yeah, what daily life is for you and what you do?
Yeah, well, I work for an organisation called the Healthy Living Centre Alliance, and that's an organisation that promotes better health and well-being for ordinary people, and particularly for people who are growing up in disadvantaged circumstances. So the Alliance is a network of 29 organisations all north of the border who combine their ideas and activities to provide a better product, to collaborate better in terms of what they or we provide to working class communities in terms of wealth, health and well-being. So we collaborate on mental health, physical health. We have a huge collaboration with the government organisations in health, working with people who live with long-term pain. We do a lot of work around social prescribing, which I'm conscious not everybody is fully aware of, but social prescribing is basically a new phenomenon that's grown up in recent times, whereby a GP can refer a patient into a community program as opposed to or alongside medication. So it's a means of tackling loneliness, isolation, people being separated from their natural community through ill health, mental ill health, and so on. And it works because it actually, GPs would tell us that a good 30 to 40% of their time is spent with patients who don't require medication. They require a better sense of connectedness with community through community development and so on. So we have responded and created social prescribing mechanisms throughout the North that that people have benefited from and still do. And we have also created a new relationship, I suppose, with general practitioners and pharmacists and so on, all of which can now refer into the community sector rather than having to medicate people or, I suppose, in some senses, we're still not being able to do anything for them. So it's created a new thought process, a new, it's created new outcomes and new sort of health pathways for people. So I chair the All Ireland Social Prescribing Network with quite a few people from right across the island. My co-chair is a man called David Robinson, who's a consultant geriatrician at St James's Hospital in Dublin. So I would do a lot of my work would be strategic, either within the North or throughout the island. But it's also about trying to improve how the various healthy living centres deliver their services to people on the ground as well. So it's good work. It's not unconnected, I suppose, from my outlook in life, which is always about trying to make things better, but trying to improve relationships, either in terms of health and the various sort of sectors that work on health and often compete. And it fits my sort of worldview as a socialist as well, I suppose, in that the health service is a very valuable tool that shouldn't fall into the hands of privatization, nor should it be abused by government. It should be treated as they are sort of equivalent of the crown jewels in a sense, and protected for everyone's benefit. I actually do think that health will be one of the unifying factors in relation to the ongoing debate about Irish unity. For instance, we're in the north, you have the National Health Service, which I think is one of the great things about Britain. Britain has a National Health Service. The Republic of Ireland doesn't have in the same way. But I do think we could have a very useful debate around what a National Health Service could look like throughout the island as a unifying factor. What Southern Ireland could learn from the North. And that's not to say that the health service here is perfect, but I think it's something to behold. It's open to abuse and all sorts of stuff, but it's still something to behold.
Yeah, down here, our health service is broken, and it's a two-tier health.
I mean, the Children's Hospital alone, the National Children's Hospital, will tell you that there's something badly wrong in the system. It's an absolute mess.
No, and it's a two-tier system as well. You know, if you've got money, you'll be treated, and if you don't, you'll just have to wait.
It's fundamentally wrong in my book.
Oh, 100%. And I've had people on from Scotland, and you know, Tommy Sheridan was on, and we spoke about Scottish independence, and you know, I said, you know, you don't want to lose your NHS, and he said, no, we just want to make it better because we are envious down here of the NHS. And because I'm close to the border here, or the old border, and like my pals can go to doctors for free, I can't. It's 55 quid for me to go to doctor, a lot of people, they're ill, but they won't go because they just can't afford it. Because not everybody makes the medical card. But listen, it's been an absolute pleasure having you on. It's tough to sometimes to listen. From the outside, and to try and put yourself in those people in their shoes, and especially the families, like it is for the families of the Hillsborough and the Stardust. But it's been magnificent. But I have it's been really good to get an insight. But every time I have a guest on, I tell them I have a Celtic Soul time machine. Now, if it's a footballer, he'll go back and relive a game. If it's a musician, he might go to a gig. If it's a politician, you might go to a moment that was that there was a victory in his political life. But like, where does it take you if you climb in? Is there a moment that you wish you could go back to, or something from your past that you'd like to revisit?
I suppose the loss of McLaur has been a profound and long lasting experience. So if I could go back, I would obviously undo that. I mean, no youngster should lose their parents, I suppose, as we did in such a brutal manner, but it happens all the time. The high points, getting out of jail was huge. Getting out of jail in 1985 was even better. All the stuff going on politically and music and always. And then I suppose I take great pride, I suppose, in relation to being asked to read the family statement in the Guildhall Square in 2010 in response to the Savile inquiry and the British Prime Minister's apology for British Sunday. That was a high point for me, and it's something I often think about. It was huge for the city. Absolutely huge. It was huge for the island. I'm told by many people, and I think for many people growing up in Britain at the time, it was huge for them as well. So, I mean, all that's for the good. I think I'm always up for trying to change people's perspective for the better. And that experience, I think, will always remain solidly beautiful in my mind. So that's what I think about in good times.
Well, Tony, all I can say is thank you so much for sharing some of your story with us. And I think after listening to this podcast, I think there'll be a lot of people going on to Amazon or going down the local bookshop and to get the full story. So once again, thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay. You're very, very welcome. You're very welcome.
Let's hope that Tony and all the families of those murdered on Bloody Sunday get the justice they deserve and that all guilty parties are brought to justice. And our thoughts are also with those families of the victims of the Stardust on Hillsborough. Folks, please follow us on social media. We're on Instagram, LinkedIn, Facebook and Twitter. And you'll find links to all our audio, video, articles and a few bits and bobs. And don't forget, folks, if you are enjoying our free content and you can afford a small donation, please click the donate button on CelticFanZine.com. And that will allow us to continue to produce quality, independent Celtic fan journalism across all our platforms and hopefully soon back in the flesh a Celtic AM or pre-match event in Glasgow. Thanks as always to Ronan McQuillan for producing this episode and his hard work all week. Also to our video editor Daniel Faulkner, Aaron Boyle who steers the good ship in Glasgow while we're away, and Richie our graphic designer, and to all our fanzine and website contributors. And of course to all our guests who joined us this week and those coming up next week for chat. Please keep listening, and as always, thanks very much to our listeners, viewers and readers for the continued support. Well folks, it's the weekend. I'll be watching the boys on Celtic TV via my virtual season ticket. That kickoff Saturday is 3 p.m. and then it's going to be all Italia Mania on Sunday, isn't it? So that's it for another Celtic Soul podcast. And this week we play out with Derry's finest once again, Declan McLaughlin, with a song called Running Up the Hill. And I think it's very appropriate for the podcast and the guests we've just had on. So folks, stay safe, keep the faith, and we'll see you next week. How many times must we do this to ourselves? Been on our knees a million times, asking for your help. Of all the answers that I don't understand, like I did not draw the firing line, but I know where to stand. Nobody told me, must have heard it all the news. People with nothing still had everything. Like running uphill, it's like running uphill. In the corner of a graveyard, a mother kneels to pray. In the memory of a son that slowly fades away. In this part of the graveyard, the sun no longer shines. There's no fences or barbed wire, but still she's doing time. Until she gets the answers to the questions that she asks, it's hard to build a future when you're haunted by the past. It's like running uphill, it's like running uphill, as the bodies hit the pavement, the world seen what you've done. As the bodies hit the pavement, somebody's singing that we will overcome. It's like running uphill, it's like running uphill. And everybody gathered here on Central Drive is marching in the shadow of the truth they tried to hide.
And every step that's taken is a breaking of your law. For your justice never added up to the murder that we saw. And time don't make no difference to the people that still care. In thousands we march the streets still knowing that you're there. It's like running uphill. It's like running uphill. It's like running uphill.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.